This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, in no particular order, we've got football and immigration, the Federal Reserve, and shopping. Come on, what else do you need? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, today the 21st of November. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. This afternoon, President Obama did what presidents do the day after a big policy announcement. He got on his big, shiny plane, he flew to a friendly city, and he gave a big speech to a friendly crowd. We have talked about the broad outlines of the president's immigration plans, more border security, help for high-skilled workers, and this is the big one, protected status and work permits for something near 4 million undocumented immigrants who meet a certain set of criteria. It is, in terms of the sheer number of people, the biggest presidential action on immigration we have ever seen. But there are, of course, some other numbers involved, the ones with dollar signs in front of them. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn starts us off today.
There will be some kind of economic impact in every industry where unauthorized immigrants already work.
Construction, manufacturing, retail, accommodation, and food services.
Patrick Oakford at the Center for American Progress says without a legal permit, workers in these low-paying service jobs have been trapped. And that means
our workforce is less productive than what it could be.
Take restaurants, for example. Economist Giovanni Perry says they're less productive because undocumented waiters are stuck working for businesses willing to look the other way. And restaurants are stuck with a smaller pool of potential waiters.
In a sense, this is a step towards more competition, more fair, and leveling the plane for more competition from the worker point of view and from the employer point of view.
The White House Council of Economic Advisors estimates that the more competitive workforce will make more money, enough to boost the GDP by 0.2% over the next decade. But all of this depends on employers and employees having confidence it'll last.
The question is how much this partial measure will convince them to stay and invest.
Christy Boswell at the American Farm Bureau Federation says it doesn't go far enough.
Even if some of our employees do qualify and are eligible, that impact doesn't create any stability for us.
The protections under Obama's executive action only last 3 years and could be reversed by the next president. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Hot button issue number two today came to us courtesy of the Senate Banking Committee, more specifically its Subcommittee on Financial Institutions. The man sitting at that long green witness table getting most of the heat today was William Dudley, who runs one of, if not the most important financial institutions in this country, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Mr. Dudley spent a whole lot of time answering questions about something called regulatory capture. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what that's all about.
Think of regulatory capture like a game of capture the flag. Fed regulators on one team, banks on the other. Except lots of Team Fed were formerly Team Bank. So yeah, they know all of the bank's plays, which helps, but they might have conflicted loyalties.
If everybody is playing on the same team, you're not going to get an independent contest.
Sid Shapiro is a professor at Wake Forest University. He says if the lines between the teams are blurred, banks might get away with things they shouldn't.
Or it may be that consumers are trying to play, but they simply are relegated to the back of the game and can't get up to the front.
Regulatory capture isn't a problem unique to the Fed, says Dan Carpenter, who studies the phenomenon at Harvard. He says if the FDA regulates a drug company too lightly, tens of thousands of patients might be affected.
But if the Fed regulates banks too lightly with respect to their safety and soundness, all of us can be affected by virtue of the highly networked and globalized economy that we live in.
We learned that during the financial crisis. And in his Senate testimony, New York Fed President William Dudley said the Fed learned that lesson, too. He gave a long list of things that have changed. But the revolving door of employees between the Fed and Wall Street persists. And that's a problem, says Lawrence Baxter. He's a professor at Duke University School of Law.
You have to have people with different backgrounds who do have expertise. And it's not Wall Street that has a monopoly over expertise, though it often likes people to think that.
Dudley, by the way, is former Goldman Sachs. But Baxter says the Fed also needs to be more transparent, so outsiders can weigh in on its decisions and whether it's getting too cozy with the banks. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On a separate but you gotta believe related note, the Federal Reserve announced yesterday, that is the Fed in Washington, not the New York branch office, the Federal Reserve announced yesterday it's going to do a big internal review of exactly how it supervises this country's banks. On Wall Street today, started real strong, faded just a tad into the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Immigration, the Fed, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, so much to talk about, so little time. Here with, then, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Lynette Lopez is from Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy is from the Wall Street Journal. Hey-ho, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Sudeep, let me start with you and ask you your gut-level response to the immigration thing that the president announced last night and gave the speech about today. The Republican Party is not happy. What do they do? Do they mess around with budget hearings and talks and do it that way, or do they shut the whole smash down and go the full Monty, if you will?
I would say they make a lot of noise, and that's what they've been making. They've been making tons of noise. They're going to continue making a lot of noise. The Republican Party is pretty split right now, as it has been for the last few years, about what to do on any kind of issue. And on this one, taking all the toys away and not playing at all is going to be a big problem for them. And they're going to be split, and you're going to see that in the coming months. So they're going to have to just talk a lot and talk it out.
Lynette, my guess is that Wall Street's going to yawn, right? The markets are going to go, oh, come on, you guys, shut up, huh?
You have to wonder if this is not like a brilliant move by President Obama, because immediately he throws down this super divisive issue, even within the party, because you've got your New York Northeast Republicans who are definitely into the idea of helping super high-skilled immigrants. Mm-hmm. And then you have the base that's like not so in love with immigration reform in general. So he's given them something that they can argue over, and Wall Street will yawn because they'll say, please do not shut us down again.
Right.
We're the best house in a bad neighborhood that is the global economy right now, while China's slowing down and, you know, the rest of the BRICS aren't looking that great. So he's betting that they'll fight, and they probably will.
I want to talk about the best house in a broken neighborhood here in a minute. But first, I want to talk, Lynette, about William Dudley, the president of the New York Fed today, on the hot seat on this idea of regulatory capture. Do you think it's much in doubt that the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the big banks are a little too cozy?
I mean, it's very hard. It's not that hard to say.
There
Goldman
you
actually.
Go. Thank you.
Yeah. Goldman actually recently fired an employee who used to be an employee of the New York Fed for sharing information between the two bodies. I mean, there is a serious problem here. And what we're starting to find is that maybe having the Fed inside the banks, we thought after the financial crisis that was going to be a great idea. Now we're seeing, hey, maybe that's not so great because now everybody likes each other, sort of.
Yeah. And Sudeep, it's worth pointing out, Fed inside the banks means actually Federal Reserve examiners are inside physically the banks. They have
the Federal Reserve has people who are sitting there who are going through the books every day. But these are enormous, complicated institutions.
Right.
They have things that are on the books that most of us don't understand. None of us understand.
Yeah, right.
Many of the people inside the banks don't even understand. And so how you get people who are obviously paid less as regulators, as bank examiners, to go in and make sense of all this stuff is a really important, difficult question that you're not going to be able to answer, particularly when the people who are creating this are being paid gobs of money to create complicated structures around them.
Right. Okay, Lynette, so on this idea of the global economy, today we had the president of the European Central Bank, the head of the European Central Bank, coming out and saying, we are going to do almost anything we have to do to stimulate the European economy, which is fading, if not faded. The Bank of China came out today and cut interest rates to get its stimulus going and to figure out a way to help that economy. We are still somehow looking pretty good, even for all the internal wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Well, it's a demand issue, and we can't hammer home this point enough. Draghi said that he was going to make sure that there was still cash flowing through the Eurozone.
Right.
In China, they kind of said they were going to cut rates, but they actually didn't, because the rate cut is actually optional for Chinese banks. It's more of a head fake, and it worked. The market loved this, but it's not going to last, because what's really in need in China is a full-scale restructuring of the corporate sector, which is where all the debt is.
Sudeep, very quickly, first of all, that's Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB. Sudeep, do you think that we get dragged down by the rest of the world, or do we power through?
Eventually, we get dragged down. There was a view once that the U.S. could decouple from the rest of the
right.
world. It doesn't work. It doesn't work in markets. It certainly doesn't work in economies anymore. You're going to see they have to go in one direction or another. Maybe everyone else will improve and catch up to us, but it seems more likely, given the state of the world, that we're going to have to pull back just a little bit.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
You
All
too,
right, we'll
Kai.
See you.
The modern-day hiring process goes a little something like this. You apply, the company likes you, and then they make you take a test or two. Screening tools before the time and money investment that comes with the interview stage of the process. Workplace personality tests, as these things are called, are multi-million dollar businesses for the companies that make them. But as those tests have gotten more popular, they have also come in for some criticism. So hiring professionals are looking at other tests they think might be better, ones that are actually a bit more playful, if you believe that. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Recently, New Yorker Jolie Pena interviewed for a job at a startup out of state.
They said, okay, before we fly out here, we have a couple of short tests we'd like you to take.
Both were online. The second test asked her to assess the way others saw her and how she saw herself. She had to pick from a bunch of adjectives. Soon, the results came back.
I started scanning it, and I just thought, this is not somebody... This isn't me.
This normally outgoing marketing specialist was described as ill at ease in social situations, formal and reserved. She was afraid she wouldn't land an interview, but maybe because she knew the company's founder, she did. Others have fallen at that first hurdle. These tests have been around a long time, says Barbara Marder with HR consulting firm Mercer. She says they may be adequate indicators for some jobs, but for others?
It might be much more important to find out about their cognitive, their neuroscience makeup.
One way to do that, she says, gaming. She says when someone plays a game, you can see his or her potential through studying what they do during play.
You're really figuring out how someone thinks, how they make decisions, how they problem solve.
Her company recently created a prototype 3D video game for the oil and gas industry. In this game, the candidate has to simulate their role on an offshore oil rig.
So at one point in the game, an alarm goes off, and we see how they respond to the safety issue. What's their level of risk tolerance? Can they figure out what's caused the alarm, and how would they respond to it?
Simulation is one route to an employee's potential, but there are plenty of other ways games can reveal your strengths and weaknesses.
I get 6 seconds for each of these.
The clock is ticking as I begin an online game designed by a startup called Pymetrics. It's one of 12 games I end up playing on their site. This one measures how well I read other people's emotions just from looking at the expression in their eyes. I have to pick the word that best describes what they're feeling.
Upset, desirous. This one looks relaxed.
MIT graduate Frida Polly is Pymetrics' CEO. She says these games are aimed at millennials.
We'd like to be sort of like the Netflix of careers, where you play the 12 games, maybe at some point we add some additional data about you, and then we really give you like a very tailored, very precise, and very good set of recommendations for what you could be good at.
Pymetrics works with candidates to compile profiles based on their play. It then matches those candidates with companies and tells the companies, hey, check this person out. They have the kinds of qualities you're looking for. And Polly says these games can help companies diversify their workforce.
There are a lot of companies in that realm, but they don't know exactly how to solve that problem.
She says the algorithms behind the games can help because they make the platform blind to race and gender.
But perhaps they're not blind to an aging brain. Some of the games I play have me sweating as the clock ticks down. I barely have time to register the direction of an on-screen arrow before it disappears.
You have to react so quickly. These things just flash up on screen and then they're gone.
If I'm being judged on this game, I fear for my employment prospects.
And that was the longest 3 minutes of my life.
Polly says I shouldn't worry.
The main point of this is that there is no right or wrong. No, I'm being completely serious. You looked, your face sort of indicated skepticism, but this is not an IQ test. It's not a am I a good person test.
And this did say that I was 70% skeptical. Which I think is quite right for a journalist.
Yes.
And a Brit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Playing this hiring game may just take a bit of practice for some of us. I'm Ashley Milne-Tight for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Many people are so desperate to shed chores that they've started outsourcing even frivolous shopping.
Frivolous shopping? How dare you. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 91 points today, about a half percent, 17,810. Who's going to be the first CNBC reporter to say, ooh, Dow 18,000? Who do you think? All right, the NASDAQ up 11 points today, a quarter percent, 4712. The S&P 500 popped up 10 points, a half percent, finished at 2,063. For the week gone by, the Dow ended up 1%. The NASDAQ closed up about a half percent. The S&P 500 finished up 1.2%. Shares of SolarCity scorched up more than 2.5% today after the company said it would provide Walmart with solar power. Walmart popped up less than 0.1%. Dow Chemical bubbled up 2.6% today on news that has settled a looming proxy fight on Friday with activist investor Third Point Capital. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.31%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In New York City, the Toy Industry Association releases its list of finalists for its annual Toy of the Year Award. Planning to stuff some stockings or stuff your mattress? The Consumer Federation of America and the Credit Union National Association unveil results of their annual survey on holiday spending plans. And Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species was first published November 24, 1859. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is, believe it or not, more snow in the forecast for Buffalo, New York tonight. Just a dusting, though, and only a 30% chance, says the National Weather Service. Then it's going to start raining, which will bring problems of its own. But in the meanwhile, there is this to consider. How do you take an entire NFL game? The Jets were scheduled to play the Bills in Buffalo on Sunday. How do you take that game, pick it up, and move it 214 miles as the crow flies so the two teams can play in Detroit on Monday night? It's a rare move and a costly one, even if you've had months to plan, never mind 6.5 feet of snow on the ground. Nova Sappho reports.
In professional sports teams, there are people dedicated to the travel of players and staff for away games. They're sort of like the George Costanzas of the fictional Yankees in Seinfeld.
Now, who are you again?
George Costanza, assistant to the traveling secretary.
Are you the guy who put us in that Ramada in Milwaukee?
Now, you know that's make-believe because professional and major college football teams wouldn't be put up at a Ramada. That's according to Kevin Green. He's the director of football operations for the University of Kansas.
The hotel has to have conference space available for meetings. That typically limits those hotels to Hiltons, Marriott's, traditional business hotels.
Green says his football team and staff usually total anywhere from 100 to 170 people. And another thing all those people need is food.
The food is very specific to individual players' positions. You're looking for specific cuts of meat, proteins, carbs that usually have to be ordered a week in advance.
When planning in advance, the price tag for travel can run somewhere in the $200,000 range. Green says the Buffalo Bills are likely paying as much as 30% extra because of their last-minute scramble. But team spending is only part of the equation.
We foresee the direct spending to be around $3 million.
That's Deanna Maychek of the Detroit Convention and Visitors Bureau. That $3 million figure includes spending by fans.
That will benefit our local hotels, restaurants, bars, and retailers.
Maychek says they're hopeful that some 30,000 fans might show up for Monday's game. I'm Nova Safa for Marketplace.
When the history of the ongoing Ebola epidemic is eventually written, the most prominent number, as it should be, will be the death toll, about 5,500 as of right now. But Christine Lagarde, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, said not too long ago that the economic fallout from the fear of Ebola will outweigh the actual costs of the disease itself. In Senegal, which I might point out has been declared Ebola-free, people have been losing their jobs because the tourists have stopped coming. The BBC's Paul Moss reports now from Dakar.
Breakfast time at the Lamantin Beach Hotel. The buffet here offers you a wide selection. Smoked fish, cold meats, tropical fruit. There's even three different kinds of pancake to choose from. They really are trying to keep tourists happy here. But right now, there's hardly anyone around to appreciate all the effort. Because for the last few months, Senegal's resorts have seen one booking after another being cancelled. It's deeply frustrating for staff here, like Joseph Diouf.
People cancel because of Ebola. Even some of our guests who are coming every year are not willing to come this year.
The country's other main earner, fishing, is also in trouble, with foreign trawlers hoovering up fish stocks, wiping out jobs in the process. Well, this is another place where jobs have been lost because of Ebola. This is Dakar's so-called Guinea market, a pretty ramshackle collection of stalls where you can buy just about anything, and where many of the stallholders, many of the shoppers, come from Guinea, Senegal's southern neighbour, where Ebola has already killed more than 1,000 people. Now, Senegal's response to Ebola was to seal the border with Guinea. But that, at a stroke, wiped out the jobs of many people here who used to make a living transporting passengers and products between the two countries. And you can see them here just sitting around watching the market, but with nothing to do.
Before Ebola, our business was going very well. We used to take people, as well as goods like clothes and shoes. Now, our business is no longer going. Because of Ebola, we cannot move. We will have to wait until they open the border. Then we will start working again.
Tourism was supposed to replace some of that lost employment. A tenth of the country's workforce now depend on it. So although Senegal may have seen off Ebola, fear of the disease alone is enough to threaten the local economy.
Paul Moss from the BBC in Dakar. We're all busy, right? There is never enough time to get done all the stuff you've got to get done. Commentator Beth Tytel reminds us that this being capitalism, the marketplace has come up with a solution that is also part of the problem, it turns out.
The do-it-yourself movement notwithstanding, many people are so desperate to shed chores that they've started outsourcing even frivolous shopping. It's a situation caused by and in turn fueling a big retail trend, subscription boxes. Subscription boxes? Yeah, even if you think you've never heard of them, you probably have. Years ago, we knew them as the fruit or cheese of the month club. Now they've gone upscale, niche, and run amok. There are subscription boxes for vegans and carnivores, for the gluten-free and gluten loaders, for people who can't get enough ostrich jerky or infinity scarves, for preschoolers who insist on sustainably sourced toys. Maybe as many as 500 boxes in all. At this point in the game, almost any American and her finicky pet could survive on boxes alone. Somehow, a nation that endlessly whines about household clutter and is so prickly about presents that there's a registry for every gift-giving event has started paying strangers to pick out, curate, random items and ship said items to their homes. And on those glum days when the mailbox is empty, junkies can fill the void with box-centric YouTube videos, blogs, reviews, and discussion boards. One theory to explain the phenomenon is that exhausted working women want a gift every month, even if it's one they've sent and paid for themselves, even if they don't actually like it. Oh, really? I shouldn't have. Recently, I flirted with a fashion box. But luckily, the realization that I'd end up schlepping to return clothes I didn't choose in the first place kicked in before I'd entered my credit card. But there is one box I'd love. A subscription that takes a box of stuff from your house every month. Call it the disappearing box.
Beth Tytel is a writer for the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth. You know what you guys ought to do? You ought to subscribe to us. Download the Marketplace app from the App Store of your choice. Take us with us. Take us with you, rather, wherever you go.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, it may or may not be this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us. I haven't really decided yet. A woman in Portland, Oregon has opened a new business. It's called Cuddle Up to Me. It is, just like it sounds, a professional cuddling establishment. All above board, by the way, nothing adult about it at all. $60 gets you an hour of spooning, and I'm quoting now, the level of human contact that we want or need in order to be our optimal selves. So come on. Hugs. Come on. Or not. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up 91 points, about a half percent. The NASDAQ hiked 11 points, a quarter of 1%. I give good hugs. I do. The S&P 500 popped up 10 points, about a half of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you next week, everybody. Have a good weekend. Hugs.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.